Before we get into today's podcast, I want to offer you a powerful free resource. We often hear from listeners looking for answers to those who claim God cannot exist for a variety of scientific reasons. But science actually supports the existence of God, which is why I want to offer you a free download called God's Not Dead. It explores scientifically how our own cosmos points to a creator in three clear areas. Again, this powerful resource is yours absolutely free, so why not download God's Not Dead for free right now at premierinsight.org/resources. That's premierinsight.org/resources. Now, here's today's podcast.
Matters of Life and Death, a podcast from Premier Unbelievable.
Well, hello and welcome to another episode of Matters of Life and Death. As always, I'm Tim Watt and I'm joined by my dad, John Watt. Hi, Dad.
Hi, it's good to be here.
And we're really pleased to welcome a guest onto the show this week. That's Dr. Daniel Morn. Hi, Daniel.
Hi.
We're really excited to have you on the show to talk a little bit about mental health, that vast topic. You're a psychiatrist working in the NHS here in the UK. Do you want to kind of explain a little bit about more about what that means and what does your work look like? What does a normal day look like for you?
Yeah, so a psychiatrist is a medic of the mind. We are trained as physical health doctors. There are so many terms that begin with psych. There's psychologists, psychotherapists. A psychiatrist is the medical doctor, as opposed to psychologists or psychotherapists who might deliver talking therapy. My job is to meet people who might have mental health problems, really get a good understanding of what those difficulties are and come to a diagnosis, something like a depressive episode or schizophrenia, bipolar, obsessive compulsive disorder. So to arrive at a diagnosis and then to move forward to consider treatment plans. And the main two types of treatment plans we have are, you know, ones that include medication and ones that include talking therapy. But there's all the holistic sides of things that we talk to with patients, which include anything from sorting out their money to housing and various other things that the patient might need. So my day looks, well, it's very varied. What can I say? Do you want to know about my clinics and how often I see patients, or would you like to know, what kind of people I see?
Yeah, I mean, what kind of people do you see? What kind of people turn up in the office of a consultant psychiatrist?
Well, the largest number of conditions are depressive and anxious conditions, but most of them are managed in primary care. Us psychiatrists tend to see the really severe depressive episodes or the really severe anxiety episodes, the ones where they're unable to leave their room, is causing massive problems in functioning. And severe obsessive compulsive conditions. But a large mainstay, maybe around 50% of presentations, are maybe schizophrenia and bipolar. These are the kind of mainstay of psychiatrists, because these are the major mental illnesses that have long-term significant disability associated with it a lot of the time. I actually work in a psychosis service, so I'm the specialist psychiatrist for Oxfordshire, dealing with psychosis.
And could you explain a bit more what psychosis is? I think most people have got a sort of vague idea, but how would you describe it?
The common perception of psychosis, and it's not helped by the name, it means split mind or detached from reality. And schizophrenia means split mind. So lots of people think that it's a Jekyll and Hyde type of picture. It's not really. What psychosis means is that you can believe things or experience things which aren't real. So believing things which aren't real might be you're being followed, or there's people out to get you, or maybe, you know, you've got a belief that maybe the aliens have landed, or, you know, something like that, which is really bizarre. The experiencing things which aren't real might be something like voices. So I'm hearing a voice. I think my neighbours are speaking about me. So delusions and hallucinations are what we call them, technically.
And you're a Christian as well as a doctor. Do you feel like your Christianity, your faith, plays much of a role in either how you got to this place or how you do your job as a psychiatrist?
So Jesus talks about having a heart for the poor, didn't he? And I think that one of the things about working as a psychiatrist is that I really meet those people who are having a really difficult time in their lives. And it is, I say, a great privilege to have access and opportunity to these people who are really struggling, to show them that they are valued, to show them that I respect them, to show them that I care for them in a deep and meaningful way. And I like to think that that is how I show Jesus's love to them. I think we have to be really careful about a power dynamic in mental health, because here are people who often are struggling to have a sense of reality, struggling with existential questions a lot of the time. And I very much see my role as a diagnostician and a caring, supporting doctor. And I'm careful actually about how much I talk about myself in any way, whether about faith or personally. Freud talks about, you know, the importance about being a blank wall, so that you can, the patients can bounce off you more easily. There's a lot to be said about that. So I do try to keep myself a bit more private for good reason, therapeutically, and to be careful of the power dynamic.
I have a special interest in this, not just because, you know, interested in medicine and ethics, but also from my personal experience of being a psychiatric inpatient and of being on the receiving end of psychiatric care. And certainly, you know, from the patient's point of view, you know, what you said rings a lot of bells, that there is this huge power dynamic. You feel as a patient incredibly vulnerable, powerless, and utterly dependent on how you are being treated. But positively, you know, I am so grateful for the skilled, compassionate, thoughtful input I received from psychiatrists who genuinely cared for me, and who, you know, so I can absolutely see what a wonderful privilege it is to be in that position, as well as at times it must be incredibly difficult.
It's funny, it is difficult, because you have access to really painful stories. And but I do think there is an ability to really empathize and understand without necessarily getting emotionally involved. And actually, there's a lot to be said for, you don't want your psychiatrist weeping with you. You want your psychiatrist to be caring, but professional, understanding, but not directly emotionally affected. So I think there's a lot to be said for reaching in and understanding the difficulty, but not, you know, feeling it like, you know, you would if you were a relative or a good friend, for example. And that is something that you do have to learn. And I do remember some of my first patients, perhaps I hadn't developed that professional demeanor, and I really did get very much involved emotionally. It really was a new thing for me. So I remember those very vividly. But, you know, you cannot continue like that. Otherwise, yes, you know, your resilience would be very poor indeed.
Yeah, no, it is interesting, isn't it? Because I've wrestled with exactly the same kind of issues as a Christian paediatrician. You know, on the one hand, wanting to empathise and to weep with those who weep, and yet at the same time, as you say, you need to retain some kind of professional boundary, precisely so that you can be trusted and leaned upon by the patients and so on. So it's a fascinating challenge, I think, too, because the opposite is also quite damaging, isn't it? When people are just totally cold and professional, it can come across as hurtful, that people don't really care.
That's right. I think there's a lot to be said for trying to find new ways of expressing people's difficulty that they haven't managed to access before that can help reshape their understanding of a problem. Sometimes that means putting it into a diagnosis. Sometimes that might mean understanding it in a non-judgmental way, or a way that allows them to see a way through the problem. And that can often be a really therapeutic, caring thing to do. For example, you know, talking about a problem like a journey. And often it might mean saying to them, I can see hope here. You might not see hope, but I know I've managed people through this, and let me hold your hope for you. Of course, I do work with people who are I section as well and take into hospital against their will. And that carries another whole dynamic of a relationship. But actually, largely, most of the time, there is a sense that we can reconnect after that period of illness, and they can see that that really was necessary at the time, and I did have their best interests at heart. That happens the vast majority of the time.
One of the narratives we hear quite a lot around mental health care services is that they're incredibly overstretched, underfunded, the waiting lists are incredibly long, and that's been put under even greater pressure in recent years since the COVID pandemic. Is that your experience, Daniel?
Absolutely. Psychosis rates have gone up. Child and adolescent presentations across the board have gone up. We're seeing that in adult services too. So yeah, absolutely. There's a sense that the COVID pandemic has sort of accelerated this sense of sort of disconnect in communities, and the sense of engaging with a virtual world almost exclusively sometimes with some people. And we know with mental health, it's so important. We are relational creatures, and it's so important to relate to other people, to be known and understood and by others, and to be in relationships. So this sense of the COVID pandemic has shut doors. It has closed people off to the outside world, and it's increased anxiety generally. Particularly cases like anxiety and agoraphobia are particular cases that have been triggered by the COVID pandemic. Goodness me, there was a lot to be anxious about in COVID, wasn't there? And it has been a real trigger for some people.
Do you think this is going to be a kind of a blip? And if when we kind of zoom out in a kind of 10, 20 year timeline, things will return to normal, whatever normal was? Or do you think this is going to kind of be a longer lasting shift in kind of society-wide epidemiology around mental health?
There's really good evidence that some conditions are pretty stable across populations and across time. So schizophrenia and bipolar are pretty stable. The more genetic conditions, these are, and so that would make sense, wouldn't it? But you look at depression, anxiety, these are the ones that have really risen. And I think if you look at our society, what COVID has done, and I think we are becoming more disconnected. We're existing more in virtual realms. And I think I struggle to see that going away anytime soon. So for that reason, you know, I do think we might not see the same acceleration, but I don't think we're going to see an ebbing of referral rates.
And what's your perspective about social media? I mean, it's a topic we've talked about in previous podcasts. But as a psychiatrist, I'd be really interested, is it just the argument, of course, goes that we can have really meaningful relationships using the internet, using all the different tools that are there. You know, why do we need to be meeting people face to face in a physical world? And so what's your take on it as a psychiatrist?
I think it's damaging. I think it's damaging because we are forcing young people to be available to the external world 24/7. Young people are engaging with potential bullies and, you know, at 2 a.m., 3 a.m. at night, they are being forced, and you know, to project themselves in as an identity that apparently should be fully formed. They need to know what they're into, what they're against. you know, teenagers often, you know, are trying to find who they are, and social media puts that pressure to say, you know, tell us now. And it's a kind of realm where it's very easy to be torn down. It's so easy to put a jibe in. It's so easy to be negative and to not like somebody or unfriend somebody, whatever the terms are. And so it's quite a brutal place. And I certainly see in my practice that there are so many casualties of social media, not only because of just the sheer amount of time that they're open and tuned into this world, which I think is unhelpful, but also because of the trauma of being bullied, you know, social media bullying. There's also one thing that I've written about, and when I see psychosis and bipolar, when they might be psychotic, they might be putting all sorts of stuff on social media that doesn't make sense, you know, saying about the MI5 following them or talking in a perhaps disinhibited way. And that's really damaging as well. And I've actually known somebody who had to actually unfriend, you know, create a whole new social media account and leave and to move to a new city because of the problems that happen through the social media account when they're unwell. That's devastating. I would say generally it's damaging.
Yeah, that's fascinating, isn't it? It's often said that, you know, everybody else forgets, but Google never forgets. You know, it's always there. And I can totally see that. I've never thought of that before, but it makes complete sense that if, you know, if I was losing the plot and then putting this whole lot of stuff out there for everybody to see, you can completely wreck any kind of relationships and trust and all that kind of stuff.
Absolutely. And it's really hard to repair as well. It's not as if you can just go and see everyone. You know, you might have hundreds of friends. What do you do? And then everything becomes, you know, what do you make a big thing of it and fess up and say, I've got this problem? Well, that's a bit unfair on that person, isn't it? So, yeah, we often, well, I take a digital history off my patients now.
I do. I like it. Digital history.
Yeah, I do. what do you do on the internet? What sites do you go to? Because let's not forget, you know, gambling is a massive thing, as is porn, and, you know, gaming as well. These massive multiplayer games, they are so addictive, and they are, I think, robbing people of the ability to form communications. One of the things I say about texting is that texting is kind of it slowly erodes the wonderful thing about face-to-face communications. And I think gaming is one step further away. And there's something that's very special, that's very spiritual about meeting another person in the flesh, that's meaningful, where you present all of you to be accepted. Okay, yes, it can be scary at times, but actually there's something healing there too, and good for our mental well-being, that we're just losing the sheer amount of time we're spending on the internet.
Is there a case for kind of preemptively winding down your online presence, even if you haven't actually experienced any mental health problems? It's not just for those who are experiencing psychosis, but actually for the rest of us, is there a case that we need to be kind of better managing our digital world?
I think Tim's getting worried, isn't he? He's clearly getting worried about this, you know. He needs a psychiatrist.
Speaking as a Twitter addict.
It depends at what cost. Are you getting those meaningful relationships? Are you having good conversations? Are you developing relationships in vivo, in the real world? Are you ensuring that you are caring for people as well as being cared for in the real world? If that's the case, then that's fine. But if it's coming at a cost, then I'd really look at that hard.
Interesting. One of the other things I was really keen to ask you for your take on is, I've been seeing some recent kind of research and news coverage around the question of medication in the mental health world, which is often a kind of contentious question among the kind of different treatment plans, is going down a kind of meditation route. And there was a fascinating piece I read in The Economist recently, which was kind of rounding up some of the recent research around antidepressants and kind of suggesting that actually in many ways, the kind of, if you look at studies in the whole, there's good evidence that actually they're little better than placebo, for some kind of more minor conditions. Are you kind of, have you been following that debate? Do you have a perspective? How much do you prescribe antidepressants for kind of more minor conditions?
The minor conditions don't get to psychiatrists. They're managed by the GP. We deal with severe cases that, you know, so I'm not blaming my GP colleagues. I think they do an absolutely fantastic job in very difficult circumstances, but they're the ones who see the mild cases, and often they don't have other alternative options other than the medication. We do have social prescribing now, which I really do support. But look, antidepressants work. Ain't no doubt about it. If you look at the numbers needed to treat compared to other medications like blood pressure pills and things like that, we are up there being, you know, not far off effectiveness levels of antibiotics and other very reliable medications. They work, no doubt about it. But you look at mild depression, and there's a question whether this is an illness, the mild depression. Is it an illness, or is it a sort of a period of sadness where people are struggling? Certainly moderate and severe depressive episodes are respond very well to antidepressants. Mild cases of depression, anxiety don't respond. And actually the evidence is, says you don't use antidepressants in mild cases. What you should use is behavioral activation. What that means is doing more, seeing more people, exercising, getting your sleep in order, cutting down alcohol, these sorts of things. So for mild cases, no, they don't work. And we've got to be careful here because there is both overtreatment and undertreatment. These are not mutually exclusive things. Overtreatment happens and undertreatment happens. So when I talk about this, I say there are people out there who should be on antidepressants who aren't, and they are maybe the moderate severe end. There are other people who've gone to their GP with a mild depression who perhaps, you know, they've tried an antidepressant, it hasn't really been that effective, and they could have tried something else as well. It's not necessarily wrong, but sometimes if somebody's a bit depressed, the GP's been a bit quick to the medication, they haven't found it that effective, it might be that they should just try other things. It's not that antidepressants aren't effective. And certainly, you know, you look at, I mean, they're lifesavers. I think they, I regularly see them saving lives. So I'm a big fan.
Do you understand why some people feel wary about starting a course of medication? I don't know. I feel like there's a culture in which, like, either it's an admission of weakness or there's a fear that once you're on them, you'll never get off them. Do you come across that among any of your patients?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I think there's a lot of stigma attached to mental health problems. And I try to be patient when I come across it because I do get frustrated about the amount of stigma. I say, we mustn't stigmatize these conditions. The brain is an organ like anything else. If the liver doesn't function very well, we should take something to help the liver, and we should do the same with the brain. Just because our mind thinks using the brain doesn't make it any more or less, you know, prone to having biological problems with it. We can get there's a confusion and a category error there. I think that we can help ourselves with things like depression, but goodness me, we can help ourselves with things like diabetes and things like liver conditions. You know, a diabetic can exercise more and lose weight and have a healthier diet and improve their diabetes. Doesn't mean they should stop having the diabetes meds though, does it?
Maybe there's a case for those, particularly in maybe church leaders and stuff, to be a bit more open about kind of, you know, wearing their own mental health conditions on their sleeves so that it helps destigmatize it, certainly in Christian communities, that if you see that your vicar or your pastor is casually dropping into conversation or in a sermon when they saw their psychiatrist or when they, you know, picked up their medication, does that help? Is that a bit of a naive approach? Is that more complicated than that?
Oh, no, I think the more vulnerability we have in the pulpit, the better. And the more, I mean, look what Stephen Fry did in the UK with bipolar disorder. He was really honest about his struggles there. And then actually we had a whole wave of people saying, I've got bipolar. Well, actually, not all of them did. But actually it was great because suddenly the stigmatized problem became something that people wore as a bit of a badge of honor because they were likened to the struggles that Stephen Fry had. And so I think there's a lot to be said for destigmatizing mental illness still. I would say that we've got to be careful about how we destigmatize mental health problems as well, because in our quest to destigmatize, we've come a long way. But in doing so, we've over-egged the medical model. And what we've done is we've said it's all illness. And I think we've disempowered people in doing that. So we've got to keep the narrative up that people have responsibility. They shouldn't be blaming themselves. But there's this sense that just because it's, you know, we need to be careful about how we talk about it. So it's not that every vicar should just fess up, because sometimes that can be damaging. We need to be nuanced about our message.
Yeah, there is this very strong tendency, isn't it, in the modern world to over-medicalize things. You know, death and dying has become very medicalized. And I think mental health is another area, isn't it? So whenever I'm having any kind of struggle or finding life difficult, I say, oh, I've got this mental health issue at the moment, and I need treatment. What's your response to that?
I think you're right, John. I think we do over-pathologize, and, you know, nobody's sad anymore. They're always depressed. I mean, anxiety is a normal term we use, but they're just anxiety disorders. The thing that I talk about, which is quite interesting to think, is doctors generally have used Greek terms for conditions. So you look at the term rosacea. Rosacea just means red face. But the patient goes to the doctor and says, I've got a red face. And the GP goes, or the doctor says, you've got rosacea. But what the GP has done is they've diagnosed a specific type of red face. The problem we've got in mental health is the patient comes on and goes, I've got depression. And the doctor says, oh, maybe you've got depression then. So it's confused, because there's no sense of difference between the common parlance of emotional variability and a medical illness. And I think from that comes a lot of problems in both people feeling confused about what depression actually means, which is a much wider syndrome than just sadness, interestingly. But it can also do discredit to the people who are actually fully clinically severely depressed, thinking, oh, maybe I'm just the same as these other guys, I'm just not coping quite as well. No, you've got a really serious condition that's really, you know, severe and needs medical treatment, and it's not the same as these other people.
That's really interesting. And maybe if we were more medically literate, we would be able to differentiate between I have anxiety and I have generalized anxiety disorder, which is, you know, in the DSM and has a list of criteria, and is, they might have the same word in them, but they're, as you're saying, they're actually quite different. They're experienced very differently.
And the way to go about thinking about this is, you know, have you done everything you can to try and help yourself? You know, have you cut down alcohol? Have you got your sleeping in order, or can't you get your sleep in order? You know, are you using all of these self-help techniques that we know of? You know, are we talking about our problems? And if none of that is working and you're still really struggling to function in a reasonable way, then that's the time to look for help, because you've sort of looked through all your strategies. So the GP shouldn't necessarily be the last, but it certainly shouldn't be the first port of call to look for help. And my concern is probably that we're reaching for it first, when actually there's a lot of, I think primary care, we talk about primary care being GPs, primary care should be us helping ourselves. Secondary care should be our friends and family helping us. And then perhaps GPs are tertiary care. I don't know.
Did you know that this month marks the 4th anniversary of Premier Insight, the ministry that brings you this podcast? While it's a real season of celebration, there's also a very real financial challenge that must be met this month. Due to rising costs and the pressure of inflation, there's a $35,000 gap that must be closed this month to keep Premier Insight moving forward with strength. So that's why I'm asking you to give a special anniversary gift to keep programs like this podcast on the air and equip a generation of Christians to live out their faith with clarity, conviction, and confidence. Simply go to premierinsight.org/matters of life and death. That's premierinsight.org/matters of life and death. Thank you for your support.
Since 2016, the Premier Gospel Awards has celebrated the heart and soul of gospel music.
Now, in 2024, powered by Compassion UK and live from London's iconic Royal Festival Hall, we're bringing you our biggest and best show yet. Join us on Saturday, September 21st, for an unforgettable night of special guests and live performances from the biggest names in the UK, USA, Africa, and more. Last year's event sold out fast, so don't wait to grab your ticket. Buy now at premiergospelawards.org.uk, the biggest ever Premier Gospel Awards. It's the culture, it's the message, it's the music.
You're listening to Matters of Life and Death, a podcast from Premier Unbelievable.
If you're right that kind of we have slightly overcorrected as a society in this state, and in trying understandably to kind of diminish stigma, we've over-diagnosed, we've over-medicalized and pathologized our emotions. Is there a role for Christians in the church to kind of push back on that gently, to maybe model a more kind of emotionally resilient way of life, rather than saying, I feel sad, therefore I have depression, or, you know, I am anxious, I'm going to immediately get signed off work for 6 weeks. Is there anything in the Christian tradition, in the Christian story, which might help us hit that balance a bit better, strike a middle ground?
Yeah, interesting, because I think the main thing we need to do in churches is destigmatize people with having mental health problems. I think that's really important, that we accept that having mental health problems doesn't mean you're not a Christian. It doesn't mean you don't have a great faith. It just means that you have a mental health problem like you might have a physical health problem. And that's the most important narrative we need to have in churches. And that is the main problem that churches have around mental health. Now, there is, as you say, you know, perhaps a place for the church to support people in their emotional resilience. And really, the church has a lot to offer here in many different ways. And there's a framework, actually, that I have for thinking about this. Have you guys come across the term biopsychosocial?
Do you want to explain it? Yep.
So as humans, we are biological, psychological, and social. God created us biologically. He also gave us an interiority, the ability to communicate, to think, to feel. He also made us social creatures. He made Eve for Adam. He created family structures because he wants us to live in community. Now, the biopsychosocial, interestingly, so I've said it's biblical, it's also the frame we use for understanding mental health problems, how they present, you know, what's the reason they present from biological, psychological, and social reasons, but also how to manage them biologically, psychologically, and socially. And my view is the church has a lot to say for the psychological and social elements of this support that mental health problems have.
So do you want to talk a little bit more about what that might look like? I can obviously, the church is not going to be doling out people antidepressants. How could they offer support, treatment, resilience in the kind of psychosocial element of it?
Yeah, so when I'm a psychiatrist, I'm thinking about biopsychosocial treatments. Biological might be antidepressant. Psychological might be a talking therapy, and social might be sorting out their housing. But look, psychological support in a church could look like a home group. It could look like a chat with a wise, mature Christian. It could look like reading the Psalms and actually really getting into and sort of in tune with some of the psalmist's despair. Maybe it can be looking at Matthew 6, the Sermon on the Mount, when Jesus talks about managing anxiety and saying, you know, be careful what you think. Do not be anxious about tomorrow. You know, think about today. Seek first the kingdom of God. What Jesus is saying there is, don't just accept your thoughts as your own, as what you are. Think critically about your thoughts. Have a critical distance between you and your thoughts, and actually think other things than perhaps what is coming into your mind, because otherwise you'll get anxious. So there's a lot to be said psychologically. Socially, of course, I mean, that's more obvious, isn't it? You know, there's coffee mornings, there's church on a Sunday morning, there's lots of different opportunities to get involved socially, but not only to receive, but to give, which is so important in mental health recovery.
So I really like this model, but I want to push back a bit and say, isn't it a fourfold model from a Christian point of view? There's biological, there's psychological, there's social and relational, but there's also spiritual. And isn't spiritual a dimension in the way we are created? We're all created as spiritual beings, whether we like it or not. We all have the capacity for relationship with God. We all understand the nature of right and wrong. And isn't that a factor in our illness? Couldn't spiritual factors, sense of guilt or maybe very bad theology, can actually be a pathogenic, you know, something, a disease creating force, as well as potentially a force for good, for healing and therapy?
There is that sort of way of looking at things. I perhaps rather controversially disagree with that. If you know, there's that old question of, you know, if you look at a pie being your bit of the week, and, you know, you've got a slice for work and a slice for your family, and these are different amounts of time you're giving them. And then you have a slice for God. And they say, don't give a slice to God, because God should have the central bit of every slice. And I think that's the same with biopsychosocial. If you look at that like a pie, you know, treating our body as a temple, that's spiritual. Engaging in relationships and loving, caring relationships, that's spiritual. Looking after your mind and managing your thoughts and understanding guilt, that's spiritual too. I wouldn't look at these as a separate piece of pie. I know there are people that disagree with me, but I think the problem is of carving spiritual out as another sort of segment in this pie is we forget how much God sees us as spiritual beings. There's not a disembodied entity of spiritualness that we have, which is separate to our biology or our relationships. I mean, goodness me, the way I understand and express my faith is hugely socially. So if I was to divorce my spiritual nature from how I relate to people, I'd be really interesting. How would I think that? So I like the fact that you brought that in, because it's a debate that's often thought about when, you know, is it biopsychosocial spiritual? I would say, you know, that all of us should be considered spiritual, and looking after your body, you know, what a spiritual thing to do, to look after that well.
Yeah, I can see that. I suppose my concern is that for most people in the psychiatric world, in the world of health, they can adopt this biopsychosocial model and effectively ignore the spiritual as being either illusory or else, you know, irrelevant. And I suppose I mean, I get what you're saying, that everything is spiritual. We can't compartmentalize it. I just don't want to forget it as a potent force of for both good and evil. I mean, one of the things I've seen as a doctor trying to help often parents struggling with the reality of having a child with special problems, brain damage, disability, is how often bad theology is a factor. You know, that I know why this has happened. God is punishing me. I know that, you know, it's all because of what happened or what I did do or didn't do. And that, you know, the potent force that spiritual factors can be in people's mental life.
And I think you're right. I mean, that would be, if you were going to use a framework in the secular world, that reason for having spirituality would be to remind people. And indeed, it is often forgotten about. It's what can you do in a secular professional setting in mental health when somebody brings up spirituality? You can point them towards the pastoral care team. You can ask about it. You can ensure that they're managing it. Rather, you know, it's more about signposting and understanding it as part of the problem. But I think as churches, you know, what we need to do is really realise that people with mental health problems, particularly depression, really do have crises of faith and really do begin to doubt about everything, whether their wife or husband might love them, whether anyone likes them, you know, whether there's any reason in the universe, and along God is lumped in with that, and they can really struggle with hope. And we know hope is so central to faith. So I think we need to be really aware of these spiritual dimensions, and I certainly don't think it should be forgotten.
One of the things I'm quite interested in is that a lot of Christian worship these days, particularly sort of Protestant evangelical worship, often seems amazingly happy clappy, sort of upbeat. Everybody's worshiping God, and isn't it amazing and wonderful? And yet there are so many people who struggle and who wrestle with their inner problems, and there's this kind of mismatch. I've heard people say, I just can't go to church because it's too positive and upbeat. And I know that you give lectures from time to time to people who are training in, to become vicars and pastors. You know, what do you say to them along these kinds of lines?
Well, as you're asking that question, I'm thinking perhaps I should say more. absolutely. There's not enough space for lament. There's certainly enough lament in the Bible. But we don't often represent that in our worship, do we? And I do have concerns when there is sort of almost an emotional contract in worship sessions that, you know, it is, these are the, this is where we're going emotionally, everyone, please jump on the train. I have a problem with that, you know, and I think that does often exclude people, not only the perhaps cynical ones, but also perhaps the suffering ones too. And I think that what we need to do to be inclusive we do need to embrace, you know, have options for people who are struggling, and to be aware that some forms of worship and some forms of communally meeting with God are more difficult, and that's about having a breadth and a range of services, service structure, having a range of formality, informality. I do know, I've met a lot of Christians who actually revert to the more formal structure of services, actually. Perhaps less is required, less is demanded. They know, you know, they're in a bit more safe space, relying on liturgy. So I think there's something in that that's interesting for me. But of course, everyone's different and might have their own leanings.
Yeah, that resonates with me, because certainly I can think of times in my past when I was struggling with my own psychiatric symptoms, including depression, and I just couldn't cope with this very positive, upbeat kind of worship. And I did find that more formal, liturgical, there's something about it, it's external, isn't it? I mean, part of the problem is with this kind of style of worship, which is, it's all in my head, I've got to, or in my emotions, I've got to try and, as you put it, you know, get on the train. And it's all about, you know, how am I engaging with what's going on here? Whereas when you're following a more set structure, it's out there. You know, I'm reading these words, I'm praying these prayers, and yeah, I'm feeling dead inside, but I can still read the words, I can still be involved.
I think that's right. And there's this real sense of what's the word, detachment that people have, but they can still experience things vicariously. And there's something beautiful and healing in churches where you do things communally, corporately, you can experience love, hope, fellowship with God vicariously. So through others in the church body, other people can hold hope, other people can praise God, other people can pray for you, which is absolutely a critical bit of living in church. And that, which makes me think of your first question, Tim, which I didn't think I answered very well, about how can we make the church more resilient? People, you know, how can we improve emotional resilience? And I'd like to answer that, because I think that one of the critical bits is story and how we understand our story. Do you mind if I say it?
No, please do. Yeah, I'm fascinated. I don't know what's coming next.
So we all, I think the thing about human beings is we live, whether we know it, we realize it or not, we exist within storylines. Okay. So we can have multiple stories going on, which it might be, well, I'm a psychiatrist, I'm a dad, I'm a member of a church, you know, I like music. You know, there's lots of different plot lines that you can have and storylines. Maybe I've got a success storyline, I've got to be really successful in my work. Maybe I've got a loneliness storyline. I always feel lonely. Nobody really likes me. You can have, I think the sense is that we can exist within these multiple stories. And, but as Christians, we are called into a redemption narrative that God gives us our ultimate story. And the thing about our multiple plot lines that we exist within, sometimes they get broke. Say success becomes very important to me as a psychiatrist and I can't get a job. Suddenly I'm a failure. Suddenly I can't feel happy. Suddenly my story can't continue. What happens then? And the great thing is, as a Christian, I can cling on to the narrative of Jesus redeeming me as a created, intended son of God that can see me through. And I, often as Christians, we can spot where problems have occurred because one plot line becomes more important than our Christian story. And we need to put our stories back where they should be, which is underneath this wonderful, loving, accepted storyline. And that's where we can really improve emotional resilience.
Can I ask a kind of controversial follow-up to that? Because that sounds really true as far as I can tell and really affirming. But are there also kind of stories, traditions, narratives within Christianity which can be harmful, which can be emotionally distressing or even kind of damaging to people's mental health or those who are vulnerable in their mental health? You know, I'm thinking of, you know, the kinds of churchmanships which might always prefer to see demon possession rather than depression. You know, do you come across that where actually churches need to learn how to reinterpret some of those Christian storylines in ways that cause less damage to people struggling with their mental health?
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right to point that out. And what I mean is the overarching story that we are created, we are, you know, chosen, we are fallen, we are all fallen, we all make mistakes, but we are all redeemed despite of them and loved despite of them. That's the narrative that I mean. But yes, you're right. Churches and people trying to follow God have created all sorts of problematic plot lines for people. I mean, goodness me, the amount of spiritual trauma that we're aware of across the board now, and people who have been affected by being bruised by other Christians is very difficult. So yes, the churches and the whole demon narrative, yeah, that's a whole nother podcast, guys.
Can you give us the top line, your elevator pitch on how you talk about demon possession and mental health in church? I chucked you in the deep end there, Daniel?
I think that there are multiple perspectives and there are lots of different ways that you can use the word demon, and it's used in lots of different ways. I think we're called as Christians to be children of truth. We're called into truth and light. And that we need to use, therefore, the most truthful explanation and the most honest explanation for things. And sometimes when we're calling mental illness demons, and I know that there's actually some problem biologically with a brain that can be treated with, when we've moved away from truth there. And that can get problematic in a clinical practice when people are engaged with perhaps an explanation for something which is right. And that can often, we talk about stories. If you've got a story that can't get better because I've got a demon I can't get rid of, well, that's not going to help you. If you've got a story where I've actually got a biological brain problem and, oh goodness, I've got a medication here that can help you with that, we've got a story because it's closer to the truth that can actually get you through.
That's really good. A bit more close to home, I think, for many of us is when church seems to exacerbate guilt feelings. Yeah, I can think of one tragic case where a teenager who I think had really struggled with a sense with her own issues was very influenced by a church that put a great deal of emphasis on sin and the need for forgiveness, and she eventually took her own life. And her father, you know, there was obviously many, many factors behind that, but I know that her father felt that this sort of negative stuff that was coming from the church actually contributed towards her own suicide.
And that's where, I mean, that's tragic, John. That's really tragic. And goodness me, if the church can't be a place where broken people are accepted and loved, you know, what are we? But I mean, it makes me think that that actually there's a lot of ignorance out there. There's a lot of judgment. I mean, can't we take the log out of our own eye? What is it about mental health problems where everyone thinks they can give an opinion? I mean, if we meet some about why it was caused. So somebody's depressed and you go, well, you made a bad decision and that's why you're depressed. We don't do that if somebody, you know, broke their leg skiing. We go, well, you shouldn't have gone skiing, should you? Well, that was your mistake. When that's a much more clear-cut causation problem. You know, we're all very happy to jump in and go, well, you've sinned and you've done that. And then that judgmental attitude, there is no place for it. Absolutely no place for it. Keep your judgment to yourself. You're probably wrong anyway. And anyway, there's no point in laying blame at somebody who's already self-stigmatizing. We need to give these people hope. We need to give these people encouragement. And actually, we've got our narrative wrong biblically. And there are huge amounts of characters in the Bible who struggle in a very real way with what, from my perspective as a psychiatrist, is clearly deep depression or deep anxiety. And we need to open our eyes to that. And yes, there weren't antidepressants around at that time, but I'd like to think that one of the psalmists or Jeremiah might well have taken advantage of those medications. I don't think God would have had a problem with that either.
That's really interesting, because I've just remembered when I was a medical student and studying psychiatry, I was reading the Psalms at the same time and saying, good grief, I can recognise, you know, ticking off all the symptoms.
That's right.
So I think you're right. And that's the wonderful thing about the scriptures, isn't it? It's so honest about the struggles, you know. There's so much about people struggling with their own feelings and emotions, and saying to God, "Where are you? And why don't you intervene? And why am I feeling like this?" And that's the wonderful things about the Psalms, isn't it? They give us language to express these feelings back to God.
Absolutely. I mean, I think that's God loving us by showing this the sense of brokenness, and Jesus showing his own brokenness too, you know, in different ways throughout the Gospels. Jesus is broken. He weeps. He's in anguish. He gets angry. You know, he really engages with his emotional world that really should help us to see that, you know, struggling is not something which we should automatically assume is sinful, and we shouldn't automatically jump to judgment. We should automatically lean on God more heavily, and we should look to our, you know, our church to help us to do so and do it with us.
Do you think there are particular mental health kind of pathologies which come up more often among people of faith or in church communities?
No.
That was an easy answer.
I heard some psychiatrist say that he thought that Christians' mental health problems self-selected towards different denominations, so that people who had a tendency to sort of obsessive compulsive disorder or depression were more likely to go for certain particular sort of conservative evangelical denominations.
You're about to piss off half our audience.
Excuse me.
No, no, I think that if you ask about the church in general, I would definitely say no, and it's important we say no. I would say that if you look at churches, from my perspective, I don't talk about illnesses, but there's definitely a sense of personality differences in different denominations. And different personalities are more prone perhaps to different problems and different types of experiences, if you know, different ways of experiencing struggle. So yeah, I mean, I could run with that, John.
I mean, I've heard you talk before about personality disorders, which is obviously kind of not the same as a mental health condition. Do you think there are certain personality disorders that we might need to kind of be aware of in church congregations?
The thing about personality disorder is that these are really broken, and people who have often been broken by others, often, you know, in their early formative years. So I wouldn't say that they're any particular type of personality disorders. And, you know, often the most common one is borderline. You've also got antisocial or narcissistic or dependent. These are people who might have lovely personalities, but certain traits are dysfunctional and cause them distress or others around them, certainly in the relationships. So I would say personality disorder is something that we should work really hard to love them in a way that shows what Christian relationship truly looks like. Because often these people have a broken form of love and a broken understanding of relationship. And it can be hard to show people what love is without being judgmental. And boundaries are important here. But yeah, personality disorder is rife in the church, just as it's rife everywhere else as well. But really, it's a sign of the world's brokenness that we've stuck a label on in the mental health world.
Yeah, definitely. Well, I think we're probably running out of time again. Unfortunately, we could have chatted all day, I'm sure, because it's been really interesting picking your brains, Daniel, and hearing some of your perspectives on this. Unless there's anything else you want to chip in, Dan, last chance. But probably need to wrap it up. Thanks so much for kind of sharing some of your thoughts.
I'd just be interested, Daniel, if people are interested in pursuing this further, you know, are there particular things you'd recommend? Books, websites, podcasts? You know, where might people go who'd like to explore some of these themes in greater depth?
The Mind and Soul Foundation is a really good website, and I can recommend them. Mind and Soul, I think it's .org, Mind and Soul Foundation. There's a book by Alan Thomas, I think it's called Tackling Mental Illness Together. I'd really recommend that book. I'd recommend a book called Christianity and Depression by Tasia Scruton. That's a good book. Most importantly, I'd recommend making sure you're talking openly to people. You are having time to understand and communicate your distress. That's the most important thing, that we keep channels open. Before reading a book, have a conversation.
Brilliant. That's really helpful. Thanks so much for joining us on Matters of Life and Death. It's been great to have you on this last two episodes. And thanks everyone for listening. I hope you found it thought-provoking and interesting and hopefully useful as well. As always, you can find some more resources on Dad's website. That's johnwyatt.com. You can get in touch with us by emailing molad@premier.org.uk. We'll be back next week with another episode, but until then, goodbye.
From Premier Unbelievable.
Since 2016, the Premier Gospel Awards has celebrated the heart and soul of gospel music. Now, in 2024, powered by Compassion UK and live from London's iconic Royal Festival Hall, we're bringing you our biggest and best show yet. Join us on Saturday, September 21st, for an unforgettable night of special guests and live performances from the biggest names in the UK, USA, Africa, and more. Last year's event sold out fast, so don't wait to grab your ticket. Buy now at premiergospelawards.org.uk. The biggest ever Premier Gospel Awards. It's the culture. It's the message. It's the music.